Okay, we're all now on record. I just want to know that, can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay, fabulous. All right. I am Ali Rodriguez, business coach, strategist, and fashionista expert. I am the proud owner of Vision Success. And if you are a dot this at the end of Vision for Success, you will find me on the web. Please visit. I just revamped the web. It has just been redesigned and relaunched, and it looks awesome. Stop by my blog and leave me a couple of your comments, all right? I have with me the pleasure of introducing to you Ms. Heather Vargas. She is an intellectual property attorney working with a firm of Cobb Cole, located at 150 Magnolia Avenue, Daytona Beach, Florida. Heather's contact information is phone number, area code 386-323-9220, and Heather's email address is heather.vargas, V-A-R-G-A-S, at cobcole.com, that is C-O-B-C-O-L-E.com, or as I was telling Heather earlier, C-O-B-B-C-O-L-E.com. How is that for a little Spanish twist? I told you guys, you know, I am at the other end of the spectrum. I love doing this. I tell you, and I hope it shows. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Heather's background. As I said, she is an intellectual property attorney, including the areas of trademark, copyright, and computer and internet law. And I know a lot of you on this call, and a lot of you also that will be listening to this call later, are very much interested in all these things that are going on right now in this particular kind of field. And Heather is admitted to practice in the states of California, Washington, and the Sunshine State, Florida. Heather is also a member of the International Trademark Association. I just want to give you a little snippet as to how I met Heather. Actually, I've known of Heather for quite a number of years, and then about 4 years ago, her husband, Omar Vargas, became a board of directors at the State Center for Girls, of which I happen to be a proud member since 2001. So I meet her husband, so I heard a lot about Heather, and lo and behold, about 2 months ago or so, as Facebook luck will have it, I see Heather's name in Facebook, and most of you on this call know I'm very active on Facebook. And I see that she becomes friends with a friend of mine, Carol Wick, who happened to be the executive director at Face a few years back. So I said, oh my God, there's Heather. So we need to connect. So we connected. And then we had lunch together. This was about 2 months ago. Right, Heather?
No, I think about that.
And we just clicked. I absolutely fell in love with Heather. She's got an amazing energy. She's super smart. And then we started to get into this business about intellectual property. Right then and there, on the spot, I knew I wanted her to do a class like this with me for the rest of you. And she agreed to do it. So we closed the deal. So that's how I met Heather. That's my how I met Heather story. So now, you know what? Without any further ado, I give you Miss Heather Vargas. So welcome, Heather.
Hi, Heather.
It's nice to be with you all. I have to tell you, I told Allie at the time that we had lunch, I love doing public speaking. I was on the radio this morning here locally. I did a radio show last week. I've done a couple of television shows. And this is my favorite part of my job because a lot of what I do requires that I stay cooped up in my office, not interacting with people. So this is great. You know, I want to second what Allie said. The purpose of this call is to be interactive, so interrupt and let's just have a conversation so I can make sure we're covering the things that you all are interested in, because I think it's all interesting.
Well,
Where do you want to start?
We agree with you. Well, the first thing, you know, I know that we all have a lot of questions, and again, I want to remind you all this call is open for all. But the one question I have for you, Heather, is, first of all, what the heck is intellectual property, and why should we care? I mean, really.
That's the name of my presentation. What is intellectual property, and why should you care? Intellectual property is just an overarching term that we use to refer to four different types of protection: trademarks, copyrights, patents, and trade secrets. And the reason you should care is because all of those have the potential to impact your business. or the business of your clients, and so you should have a working knowledge of what they are and whether you're doing what you need to do to protect them. And just to give you a little bit of information about each of those, let's start with patents. Patents are for the protection of an idea or an invention. So if you build a better mousetrap or improve upon an existing business method, then a patent is the intellectual property technique that you need to use to protect that idea. A trademark is for the protection of a brand. This one's pretty easily accessible. We all are fully embedded in brands. I'm just looking around my desk, and I have here my Diet Coke and my Walgreens sore throat spray and my V8. Trademarks are just everywhere. And copyrights are for the protection of the expression of an idea. So Ali's new website, he has copyright protection for that website. Any software code can be protected by copyright. Your Great American Novel, my outline for this talk, anything that is creative expression that sits in a tangible medium, be it in writing, recorded, or in the hard drive of a computer. And then finally, trade secrets. Trade secrets are, very simply, confidential information that is valuable because your competitors don't know it. And that can get a little tricky until you think of specific examples, like I'm sure none of us would share our customer list with our most vehement competitor. That's a trade secret. Or your price list, or your margins, or your vendor list. Any of those things can be a trade secret, and you keep them secret because they would be of economic value to your competitors. So those are your four types: patents, trademarks, copyrights, and trade secrets. So where do we want to go from there?
Can I ask a question, Ms. Barbara?
Yes, Barb.
Yeah, I've always done a poor man's copyright. I used to do it through the Library of Congress, and I know you can do it online. I just wrote four pilots for TV shows, and I sent it to myself. I registered and sent it to myself, but then I did it online, and then they called me and said it wasn't registered for some reason, but I do have a number. So can you tell me a little bit about that self? Is the poor man's copyright just as good, as legal, if you went to court?
This is a great question, and I promise you I get it every single time I do one of these talks. It is one of the most well-known copyright, and I hesitate to use this word, but I'm going to use it anyway, myth. It's not useless, but it's not the most valuable way to do this. Copyright is best in the creator of a work at the time that it's created. So when you wrote those pilots, you own the copyright. You already own it.
Okay.
But in order to be able to sue someone for infringement, which is the only way you can enforce that copyright, you have to register it with the Copyright Office.
Okay.
And it sounds like you took the first steps towards doing that. You went ahead and used the online form, which is great. I encourage people to file their own copyrights because it is a fairly straightforward process. But they flip you up with certain questions.
Yeah.
And there's some certain terms of art that they use that can be a little confusing.
It was very confusing for me.
Yeah.
What is it online?
Copyright.gov is the Copyright Office website, and if you have a work that you want to register the copyright in, then you simply go online, you fill out the form, and you send $45 and a copy of the work to the Library of Congress, and you can do it all through their website.
I had four pilots, and I didn't know that you could register them all under one, I don't know how to put this. I was going to register each one individually, but you can register them all under one piece of work, I think. And I was really confused about that.
You can register them all together, but it's not what I would advise.
Okay.
I would advise registering each one individually. And the reason is, if you put them all together and only one of them is infringed, then you have to establish that that is a sufficient amount of copying by the infringer. Now you've got 25% of it, and maybe only part of that is being infringed. Whereas if it's own registration and someone takes half of it, well, then that's half. and it's more substantial portion of the whole that's being infringed.
Yeah, I understand. Well, that's really interesting. Let me ask you this then. Let's say for a website, you just register the individual website, not all of the pages within the website, right? You don't go page by page of the website. And let's say that I have 20 websites.
If I'm doing a website and I want protection for the whole website, then I'm going to register every single page.
Oh, really?
But I'm going to do it all together. I'm going to do that as one work.
Okay, a body of work, right?
Exactly. I'm going to do that
yeah.
as one copyright application with the website
yeah.
Pages attached.
Right. Okay.
And if I can just circle back around to the question Barbara asked. Barbara asked about the poor man's copyright.
Yes.
And what this is when you take a copy of your work and you put it in an envelope and you mail it to yourself and you sign it across the seal of the envelope, so then you have the postmark that establishes the date and your work is safely tucked inside.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that people do that is because it establishes the date that you created the work. It shows
right.
that if anyone comes up with something after that, they say you were first.
Mm-hmm.
It is moderately good evidence of the date that it says on the postmark
mm-hmm.
if you should get into infringement dispute. And so it does give you that evidence if you ever get into an infringement lawsuit, but you can't get into the infringement lawsuit until you have your registration in place.
Okay.
So it's not a bad idea, but it doesn't replace your copyright registration.
Mm-hmm. And
I have a question.
Okay, go right ahead.
The Library of Congress, is this copywriting in the United States? I'm in Canada.
You have a copyright office all your own, and it would be the same thing. I'm not sure if you all are online yet or not. I haven't tried to do a registration there recently, but copyright protection is quite global. There is an international copyright treaty that many, many countries are signatories to. And basically what it says is, you have a registration in your country, we in the United States need to afford you the same rights that you would get in Canada when you utilize that work in the United States. And it's a good idea to register it in the United States as well if you're going to be using it in the United States, if you're going to be selling it in the United States. But we can't inhibit your registration because you're from another country and vice versa. All right, where do we want to go next?
Heather?
Yeah.
Heather, this is Deborah in Pennsylvania.
Hi, Deborah in Pennsylvania. I'm Miss Snow.
Hello, Heather in Florida. I'll try to forgive you for that. One of the things that probably a lot of us have been involved with is writing articles for submission to the internet on articles.com and various, or easyandarticles.com and various other types of publication outlets for us, which we know drives traffic to our website and what have you. But how are we protected from that? Because as far as I know, we're not able to put any copyright, even the logo, you know, on the bottom of our piece once to submit that document into their little, you know, rules that they have, and do we lose protection, or are we somehow covered under their protection?
I don't know what their terms of service say, but assuming that they don't require you to assign the copyright to them, you still own it. Under the current Copyright Act, this wasn't always true, but it is true now, you don't have to put the copyright notice on your work in order for it to be protected. And for those of you who are not familiar with what a copyright notice looks like, it's the C in the circle. The proper notice will have the C in the circle, the name of the author, which is going to be your business if you wrote it for your business, and then the year in which it was created. And you should apply that whenever you can to your copyrighted work. But if you can't because of the way a particular website requires you to do your submissions, you don't lose protection. The value in having the copyright notice is it serves as a warning that you believe this to be your work and that you can't, and it prevents an infringement defense. If you do have to sue someone for a copyright infringement, they can't claim innocent infringement if your copyright notice is on there.
And can we put the copyright notice on even if we haven't gone through the copyright.gov website?
Yes, you can, because you own the copyright from the time you create
Okay. And then if we had to take it to court, then we'd have to go through the $45 and get it registered, but then and then proceed if we believe we were infringed upon. Okay, thank you.
And let me expand upon that a little bit. You're not required to register your copyright. You don't have to, unless you want to enforce it. But if you are going to register it, you should try and do it within 3 months of the first time that the information, that the article becomes publicly available. Because if you wait until after the work is in print, then the damages that you're able to recover, what you're able to get in the lawsuit, is severely diminished. You can't get statutory attorney's fees that are available. You can't get statutory damages, which are available, and you can't get attorney's fees. And copyright litigation is extremely expensive. I mean, we're talking several $100,000 to get through a lawsuit, win or lose. And if you can't get that back, it very often isn't even worth it to go through the infringement litigation.
Thank you.
So, this is Barbara again. So it's much better, like when I wrote the pilots and before I went out to California to show it to these producers, I got it copyrighted before I met with them.
That's good.
Yeah. But you know what? They have you come and go now in California because they make you sign an agreement that before they'll talk to you, you can't sue them, blah, 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 if they pass it on to somebody else. So you're caught between a rock and a hard place that if you want to promote your pilot, you have to sign it. Do you know what I'm saying?
They don't call it the Wild West for nothing.
That's funny. Oh, man. And I was going to have them sign a non-disclosure, but then I thought, they're going to really throw me out the door. What?
Boy, I would have thought you guys had that planned if I didn't know any better.
What?
I said, I would have thought you guys had that planned out if I didn't know any better. That was a great answer.
Oh, my God. Yeah, but, you know, I was going to have him sign a non-disclosure. Yeah, I'll sign this, but you'll sign that, you know? And then I thought, oh, man, they're going to just throw me right out of the office. I'm not even going to get to talk to them. But, you know, in show business, anything goes because they can change it around. You give them an idea. They could just change it, twist it, and you prove it, right, Heather?
Yeah, and that's exactly, you're exactly right.
Are you there?
Yeah. Someone? Heather, are you there?
Oh, we lost her.
I hope that she'll call back. Heather, if you hit 6, just hit star 6 again and you will unmute yourself. We're going to get her back.
Can I just make a couple comments?
Absolutely, yeah, because we're on record, so, you know, this is an audio clip that you're all going to get back and that you can listen and re-listen to it, so go right ahead.
So, as I understand, with non-disclosure, in the end, they can do anything they want, like you mentioned. Like, they just have to change one word, and then they can claim it to be theirs. So non-disclosure isn't an ironclad guarantee. But the thing about it is you're establishing a statement. You're establishing a position, saying this is what we're agreeing to. But
wise
to understand that it's.
Hey, I got
happen.
Dropped off the call.
Yeah,
I got two. I got dropped off and I had to get back on. Were you two, Heather?
Yes. I just I was out for a minute there.
Yeah, me too.
We figured that we knew at one given point that we lost Heather. I wasn't sure who else got lost.
Me too, Barbara. You lost, but anyway, I'm back.
Okay, so the two of you are back. Gee, you guys got tremendous energy. You knocked each other off. You guys must be Sagittarians, I'm sure.
We're Sagittarians, I'm convinced, yes.
Okay, all right.
Oh, but non-disclosure. We were talking about the non-disclosure, right?
Yeah.
Oh,
Heather,
right.
You still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. And what I was starting to say before I got a dial tone was that there's a great case out of California where someone was talking about copyright protection, and they went to the judge and they said, look, we have this napkin, and on this napkin we wrote that I was going to own the copyright in this and that the other person was giving it to me, and that was deemed insufficient. And the judge made fun of California, of Hollywood types, and said, in Hollywood, they tell us that they don't do contracts, they do lunch.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Could I make?
Yeah.
I was just commenting on non-disclosure. As I understand it, in the end, it isn't any real protection because they can, in fact, just change some one thing and claim that it's theirs.
Well,
but what
I mean, that's... Go ahead.
But what I understand about actually having them sign the non-disclosure is it's putting something in place as an acknowledgement between the two parties. And that has value for me. At the same time, knowing that, you know, you can't, it's not ironclad. What it comes back to for me is a relationship of trust. But that that document is a reassurance, and it's part of the doing good business to hold each other accountable. Not that it's ironclad, but it's doing good business.
Well, and the truth about non-disclosures is that their enforceability depends on a lot of different variables. One is where you are. Non-disclosures are pretty enforceable in Florida. In different parts of the country, they're not. In other countries, they might not be enforceable at all. But I think you're exactly right. I think if you don't trust someone, a non-disclosure isn't going to make them trust you.
Yeah, well,
the other thing that I wanted to comment about with respect to this and back to the copyright is that what I have been taught is that you establish a history with the idea that if you do ever have to go to court around this kind of issue, it's the history that you've documented that has great value, and that's very important, as much as even copywriting, that you establish a history of the relationship with this person and the information that's been shared, as a way of supporting your case if you had to go to court, and that in the end, copyright infringement, non-disclosure problems are a matter that is a legal matter in court, and that's what you're looking towards, is that day that you might have to go to court and providing the documentation that proves the history that it was in fact yours. So, for example, with my project, I have 20 iterations of each piece of writing, and it's documented on email and in meetings, so that's my background of data that I can use to prove that this is in fact my idea and my work, and that's
oh, yeah.
This is an excellent point, and it's actually true for all types of intellectual property. You're going to want to establish the date that you came up with the idea or developed the brand or finished the work that's subject to copyright protection or developed the process that you're attempting to keep a secret. Any time that you can keep business records in association with the development of these intellectual property items, that's going to be valuable to an attorney who's trying to protect your intellectual property someday. Very often, it's easiest to see in a patent where a scientist keeps a journal of the development of a new drug or the development of a new device, and that journal is extremely valuable. Again, with trademarks, the person who's going to win in a trademark infringement lawsuit, assuming that the trademarks at issue are similar enough to confuse consumers, is the person who used it first. And so if you can establish that you were the first person to use it or the first person to file for federal trademark protection, then that's going to be the most valuable information. Keeping good records about these things, you're exactly right. That is critical to your protection.
That's an excellent point about the filing for the trademark. When do you think it's a good idea for people to file for trademark?
Well, let me first tell you why you would file for federal trademark protection, because that'll help you understand when it's going to be right for your business.
Okay.
Trademarks, like copyrights, vest automatically based on use in commerce. So the first time you sell your A1 widget, then you have protection for your trademark in the market where you're selling the product. The reason you want to get federal trademark protection is it gives you national rights. It gives you rights all over the United States. And we can talk a little bit about international protection in a minute. But federal trademark registration gives you protection across the United States regardless of where you're using it. And the purpose for this is obviously it allows you to expand in the future without someone else coming in and using the same mark elsewhere in the country and blocking you.
Mm-hmm.
So the time you're going to want to get federal registration is when you initially start using the mark, if you know that you're going to expand, and if this mark is essential to your business. Because you're going to spend between $2,000 and $3,500 to get this registration. If you do that and you later have to get into litigation, you're going to have some substantial evidence on your side already. Because a federal trademark registration gives you the presumption in court that you were the first to use it, that the registration is valid, and that you're the owner. None of that makes a lot of sense or use to you right now, but I promise you it's very useful in litigation.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got a business, if you've got a brand that you're using in your business that is critical enough that you would want to spend money to defend it, then that's the one that you need to be looking at trademark protection for.
Mm-hmm. Why so much money?
Well, there's a process that you have to go through for trademark protection, and the first thing that I always recommend for clients is a trademark search. This is going to tell us if there's already somebody out there using it. Because if there is, we're going to recommend against the registration, and we're going to recommend that you adopt another mark, because you don't want to get into an infringement fight. It's extremely expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Trademark infringement, again, it's several hundred thousand dollars worth of litigation.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing we do is a search. And this is a search, we order these from a company that does this as their business. And it tells us not only what's in the Patent and Trademark Office database, but the state registration databases, the common law databases. They do research into industry journals, and they do a web search and a domain name search and a Dun & Bradstreet search. It just gives us a very good look at how the term that you want to use as a trademark is being used right now, so that we can ascertain whether you're going to have an infringement problem or if you're getting into a market that's very crowded with that name and you might want to pick something more distinctive.
Mm-hmm.
So that search and the opinion letter that we write that goes along with it is about $1,500. Then your trademark application, there's a $275 to $325 filing fee with the Patent and Trademark Office, and that's if we're only filing in one class. And when I say one class, every product or service is broken down into one of 45 classes, and you file by class.
Ooh.
And then, so there you're going to spend another maybe $500 between the filing fee and our fees to prepare the application. And then virtually all applications get an objection from the trademark office. So the remainder is filing the response and then letting you know about when the registration issues.
So if I'm in Canada, do I need to do this kind of activity for the United States as well? If I have an international global product?
What you can do, and unfortunately Canada is not a signatory to the primary international trademark agreement, which is the Madrid Protocol, so you would actually have to do a U.S. national application. So you would go precisely through the same process that I just explained, but you would need to do it once in Canada, once in the United States, and once in any other country in which you're doing business. In the United States, we have the option of using the primary trademark agreement, the Madrid Protocol, to extend a U.S. application or registration into additional countries where we want to do business.
So it's actually easier to do it from the United States because we have easier access to have an international trademark situation than it is if you're in Canada having to go to the USA and then into the international market, right?
It is easier to an extent. There are some problems with the Madrid Protocol from the United States perspective in that, for example, let's say I have a business and I make T-shirts and hats, and I have a U.S. registration for T-shirts and hats. Well, if I file an application in France, I can register for clothing, which is its own international class, and I can just register my mark for class 25. But if I do a designation from the United States into France, then my registration is for T-shirts and hats instead of for clothing. The U.S. requires very narrow descriptions, So there are some problems with using U.S. as your home country. And in some cases, even though we have the option of using an extension based on the Madrid Protocol, we do national applications anyway because it gives you broader protection.
I have another question. As I understand it, I can trademark a logo, a name, and a slogan, correct?
Yes. And typically what I recommend is that you always do the word mark first. So if the name of your business is, Platypus on Wheels Bike Shop, I say always do the word first, do the design separately, and do your slogan separately instead of doing them all together.
All right, and so what I also understand is that until I've paid for the actual trademark registration, if I just put a little TM on the name and the slogan and the logo in my work, that, you know, that's in place, and, you know, until I go ahead and register, at least I have that just sitting there so people can see it. Like, that's what I'm doing right now.
Exactly. And what you're doing by putting a little TM on your work is you're claiming your common law trademark rights. What you're saying is, I know that in my market where I've offered my services, I have common law trademark rights and I can prevent other people from using it. If you have a registration, then instead of the little TM, you're able to put the registered trademark symbol, which is the R in the circle.
Oh, okay. Because I know even big companies sometimes just leave it as the little TM. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. A lot of people never switch it over. It's a matter of communication between the legal department and the marketing department in a lot of cases.
So there is protection with just that action of doing that.
Yes.
If I have a document history.
And now I'm speaking to the person in Canada, right?
Yeah.
At this moment.
Yeah.
Canada is a little bit different, and I don't want to lead you astray. I'm not certain that actually works in Canada the way it works in the United States. Unlike the United States.
It does.
Okay.
From what
I know. Most countries outside the U.S. are first-to-file countries. So in the U.S., we're a first-to-use country. The first person who uses the mark has the right to prevent others from using it within their market. Most other countries are first-to-file countries, which means the first person to the trademark office wins, whether someone else used it first or not. So if anyone particularly is doing business in South America or in Europe, there's even more pressure to file your trademark registration early.
With reference to trade secrets, I've been pitching my project. It's a film called Little Huge, and I've been pitching it to different people, and I've had some people sign non-disclosures and other people I haven't. And what I'm feeling is that I'm going to go back to those people who I don't feel totally comfortable with and request that they do sign a non-disclosure after the fact, just because I believe, again, it's just establishing an attitude and a position and a professionalism in business that let's get this in place. And I feel that that's appropriate.
I think you're exactly right. I think to the extent that you can get someone to sign a non-disclosure, it can't hurt you.
Yeah.
It can only help you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Heather, let's move right along unless somebody has another specific question here for Heather. This always happens that we think an hour is just like a long time, and next thing we know, you got to be joking. We're not done yet. We got more questions. And I thought, we would talk a little bit also about what is fair use under copyright.
This is a big issue in the news right now. I don't know how many of you are following this or if this is just a copyright nerd thing. Have you all heard about the Obama poster case?
No. Oh, yes. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. So for those of you who haven't heard about this yet, the AP photographer takes a picture of Obama, and it goes out in the AP wire, and it gets published all over the place. Shepard Fairey picks up this picture, and he turns it into the red and blue Obama Hope poster that's everywhere. And ultimately now, several months later, he's getting sued for copyright infringement. This is a really, really interesting case because it brings to the fore how complicated fair use is. So let's back up a little bit and talk about what copyright infringement is first. Copyright infringement is established when, let's say, I own the work. It's mine. I own the copyright in it, and I have the registration for it. And someone else creates a work that is substantially similar. Substantially similar is the standard for copyright infringement. It's based on a layperson's perspective. And essentially, if I am in court on a copyright infringement case, the standard is I put the two things next to each other. If somebody goes, hey, that one kind of reminds me of the other one, we're talking copyright infringement. So it's a really squishy standard. And what's even more squishy is fair use. Fair use is based on, the theory of fair use is, yes, I copied it, but I have a right to use it because, you know, I'm an educational institution or I changed it or whatever the reason might be. People talk about fair use a lot, and it is extremely hard to guess how a fair use case is going to come out. I've been practicing intellectual property law for 10 years. I have no idea how the Shepard Fairey case is going to turn out. I think it's infringement. A lot of other intellectual property attorneys agree with me. A whole bunch more think I'm wrong and think it's fair use. But let's talk about what fair use is because it's a big issue and it's something that comes up for people fairly regularly. The way we would determine if something is fair use or not is based on a four-factor test. And the first factor is the purpose and character of the use. Essentially, if someone transforms a work from the work, the original, into something that's new and entirely different, then it may be considered fair use. So if I write a book and someone takes a line out of the book and turns it into a song, that's a complete transformation and it would be fair use. Transformation is the argument that Shepard Fairey is making against the AP in this case. What he's saying is that he took the photograph and he completely transformed it into something different. I can't say I love that argument because he took a photograph and he basically turned it into a poster. He didn't take a photograph and turn it into a sculpture or into a tablecloth. He turned it into a different kind of photograph. Though, of course, it appears different because of the changing in colors. The second factor in the fair use analysis is whether the work is creative or factual. You know, it's easier to infringe a creative work because it's made up as opposed to a factual work. If something's completely factual, then it's difficult to infringe it. And this is another argument that Shepard Fairey is making. He's saying, look, you took this picture at a meeting, and all you did was snap a picture of a newsworthy event as it was happening. This is factual, so that works to my benefit in my argument for fair use. I actually kind of like that argument. It's unusual, and I'll be really interested to see how that one turns out. The third factor in the fair use analysis is how much of the work is used. So if I rip off an entire Dr. Seuss poem, that's likely to be infringement. If I use two lines, I might be okay, unless those two lines are the essential part of the work. And this comes from a case back maybe 30 years ago now. Time magazine had an excerpt of a book about Gerald Ford. And there was a section of that book that was explosive. It was just going to give out this incredible, bit of information, and this is what everybody wanted to read about. And Time had an exclusive on printing that section of the book. Well, the Nation somehow got a hold of that section, and they printed it first. And they said, look, we took 300 words out of a 600-page book. This is fair use because we use such a small portion of it. The case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court says, no, if you take the heart out of something, that's copyright infringement and not fair use. But in general, when you're claiming fair use, it's going to be, I took a small portion of it. And so it's not the entire thing that was infringed. This is not an argument that's going to work in Shepard Fairey's favor. Because he basically took the heart of the picture. He took the whole picture. And then the final factor in a fair use analysis, and the one that actually carries the most weight, is what is the effect on the plaintiff's market? If the plaintiff still has the ability to exploit their work completely, then it's not likely to be infringement. It's likely to be fair use. And I think that in most cases, this is what it really comes down to. Have you affected the ability of the plaintiff to use their work? And I think Shepherd Fairey is going to get in some trouble there because it's a lot harder to license that photo now that someone else has already used it in the way that Shepherd Fairey has. So we're all real curious to see how that case turns out. If we've got a couple of minutes, the other thing I'd really like for you all to hear about is the work made for hire doctrine. Is it all right, Allie, if I go ahead with that?
Oh, please. Yeah, actually, I think we're all curious about that because there are many gray areas about it. Yes.
The work made for hire doctrine gets, that phrase gets tossed around a lot and has a very specific meaning that's a lot narrower than most people understand. The idea behind a work made for hire is that the copyright, as we talked about, copyright vests in the person who creates the work at the time of creation. The work made for hire doctrine alters that rule by vesting the copyright in the employer of the person who creates it. And a lot of people assume that if you pay someone to create something for you, the work made for hire doctrine automatically applies. And that is not necessarily true. The work made for hire doctrine only applies if someone is your employee, and if they're a W-2 employee and they're an agent for all purposes and they're doing the work within the scope of the employment that they are, within the scope of their employment, then that the work that they create is subject to the work made for hire doctrine, and the work vests in the employer, the copyright and the work vests in the employer. Other than that, if someone is an independent contractor, it is not a work made for hire. There are some very limited categories in which it will be deemed a work made for hire if you have a written agreement that says it's a work made for hire and it falls into one of 9 narrow enumerated categories. But to protect yourself, what you want is an assignment of the copyright. So let's say you go out and you hire a website designer to create a new website for you. And you want to make sure that you own the copyright in that so that they don't go out the next day and create a website for somebody else that looks exactly like yours. And what you want from that website designer is an assignment of the copyright back to you, and that should be part of the contract that you enter into when you agree to pay them for that website. They should agree to assign the copyright back to you. Did that make sense?
Yeah.
Allie was in the presentation I gave a couple of weeks ago, and I said there are 2 things that you need to take away from this if there's nothing else. Make sure you own your domain name. Second, make sure that you own the domain name for your business, because if you allow your website designer to own the registration for your domain name, when they get mad at you, they're going to take the website down.
Oh, it's the truth. That happened to me. That happened to me. I was with this guy. His name was Rosio. And he said, don't worry about it. I'll file it for you. I was so stupid. I didn't know any better. And he put it in his name, the domain name.
You're not stupid. It happens to everybody every day. I see this at least once a month.
Yeah, and I was with him like 5 years, and finally I couldn't tolerate his incompetence anymore. And my cousin came in on the scene. Her name is Kate, and she did my website. He wasn't doing anything in a timely fashion, blah, blah, blah. So I said to him, listen, we're going to call it quits. And he said, well, I'm just going to shut your website down. And I was like, what? And then she looked into it. She goes, he owns the domain name.
Yep.
And I had to, like, I don't know how I got it out of his name. I just appealed to his good sense. I said, this is, you know, against the law. You did this without my knowledge, and you better do something about it. We were neighbors, you know.
So you got your domain name back under your name.
Yeah. I had actually 4 domain names, but he turned them all over. Because I said to him, you don't want me to sue you, do you? You know, for what you did. So, yeah. And you really
That's the point that Heather wants to make right now, that when it comes to website assignments, first of all, own the domain name.
Mm-hmm.
That's correct, Heather, right?
Yes, own the domain name and own your website. Make sure that when you have your website developed that you get an assignment from your website developer in the look and feel of the website, because if you don't, then there are limitations on what you can do with your website when you take it away from that designer, and they go out and create another website that looks exactly like yours for somebody else.
Okay, well.
And I'm not going to, I'm not ragging on website designers because my husband does that, but.
Well, well, what do you do? Well, you better get something from him in writing. That's all I have to tell you, Heather. Well, this is my cousin that's doing it, you know, and it never occurred to me, you know, she put copyright on everything, you know, for my protection. But, so what do I have to get from her?
Just an assignment of the copyright. And I encourage you to hire a copyright lawyer to draft that for you because there, you know, you have to make sure that it says assignment and it says copyright, and there are certain sort of magic words that have to be in there about the date that it's created and how you're going to handle future revisions to the site and things like that.
Well, I've given you Heather's telephone number, and we will do that again before the end of the call. So, yeah, this is so super important because I believe that most of us on this call and most of the folks that are going to be listening to this call later on, we all have a presence. We all have an online presence of one fashion or another, and we are all very much attached to our own creation. This is what this class, this call is all about. It's how do you protect what is near and dear to your heart, which is your creation, whether you speak it, whether you hear it, whether you put it in audio, whether you create a program, whether it's a website, or whether you just decide to stand a corner upside down and let others take pictures of you. They're just pictures, and this is what Heather is here for, to help us navigate through some of these waters that at times they can become extremely murky. I wasn't quite clear either with the work made for hire doctrine. I thought I actually understood it, and now Heather threw a little bit more light on it, which is, okay. I thought I got it the other day, and now I even get it more, so thank you, Heather, for that.
So I have another question to ask.
Go ahead, Kathy.
This is with reference to the Internet and all of the pictures that are available on the Internet with reference to using them. If they don't indicate underneath some copyright, if you're just taking it from someone else's, blog or Facebook, or even if it's from images from Google, what can you tell us about that copyright requirements there?
Well, you have to assume that copyright protection still exists in those works, and that someone else owns that copyright, and if you're using it publicly, there's a chance that you're going to get tagged for copyright infringement. The Internet has made it very easy for us to pick up other people's works and move them around and use them as we like, but the rules haven't changed. If you take someone's creative work, you can get seriously in serious trouble for it. And I find very often that if there's something I want to use on a website, I'll send an email to the webmaster and say, hey, this is what I want to use it for. Can I have permission? As long as you have permission, you're fine.
So I can
and
do
let
that
me
speak after the
something.
Fact. As well. I can do that after the fact as well, right?
Sure, because most people don't care. The problem is if someone cares and they find you, you've suddenly got yourself in an expensive mess.
Uh-huh. So we have a situation with Facebook, and I don't know if anybody wants to bring it up, but they, all of a sudden they changed the terms of service on us, and they told us that even when we close our accounts, that everything that we have posted, including all of our video clips, audio clips, and pictures, albums, anything, it's no longer ours. It belongs to them, and they can do with it as they please. This happened about 3 weeks ago, and I think it was last week or so where they rearranged it, and now they said they changed it. But that was pretty scary, and of course now there's such a huge entity, Facebook is, so, you know, what can we do? You know, how do you fight that particular city hall if you can?
Well, here's something that I write terms of use for my clients for their websites, and I write privacy policies,
mm-hmm.
and I understand why Facebook did what they did.
Why?
Because if there's something floating around and they don't know what the genesis of it is and they want to use it, it gives them the flexibility to use it. It's not that they actually want to own all the pictures of my kids from Halloween. It's just that it gives them the flexibility to do what they need to do in their business without having to worry about the copyright infringement that we were just talking about. So that's why they did it. I don't think that they had any intention to be evil, but they certainly got smocked around a good bit for it and
mm-hmm.
had to pull those down. And now I understand they've started a new forum where you can get on and talk about what you think their terms of service should be.
Mm-hmm.
But I also understand why it made people mad. You know, people get very angry when they see some of the terms of service I write. But you do it to give the business the flexibility to use the materials on their website in the way that, that is most beneficial for the business, because that's why they're putting the website up there in the first place. I will tell you, we all blithely click those I agree buttons when we get to a website that we want to use or we get to a, an online service that we want to use. I put some scary stuff in those things. You should definitely read them. I know they're a pain, but you should definitely read them so you know what you're getting yourself into.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I just read an article today about a case, and let me see, I actually have it here in front of me. It's out of the Sixth Circuit. I'm trying to see what state it is. Ohio. A case where a man was arrested because he got involved with a 14-year-old who claimed online to be an 18-year-old. And so he went after the website that, introduced him to the girl, and they had disclaimers in their terms of service. We can't promise that everything that someone tells you on the site is true, and you can't sue us if something happens.
Mm-hmm.
And the court upheld it.
There you go.
There are a lot
yeah.
of protections available for websites. And looking at this from the other side, if you all have websites and you're allowing people to participate on your websites or post information
mm-hmm.
on your website,
mm-hmm.
there are a number of federal laws that you should be aware of and make sure that you have references to them in your terms of service, so that you're maximizing your protection against copyright infringement or defamation or libel or all those things that can get you in a certain amount of trouble if people are posting information on your website.
Okay, so you're saying that even on blog posts, you need to have a terms of service statement?
I would say any website needs a terms of service. Unless you've got something up that says, hi, my name is Allie, and I can be reached through this phone number,
mm-hmm.
you've probably got a reason why you would need a terms of service and or a privacy policy. And if you're accepting any information about people, then you're going to want a privacy policy so that you can explain what you're doing with that information.
Very interesting.
In a totally self-serving comment, everything I'm talking about is federal law. Copyright
mm-hmm.
is federal law, trademark is federal law.
Mm-hmm.
These laws are about the online use of information. These are federal, and so it doesn't matter that I'm a Florida, California, Washington lawyer. If you need advice in Ohio, I can give it to you because it's federal law and not state-based.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Can you trademark your name? Yes. Yeah.
You can. I'm going to
trademark my name, like Pepsi.
There's a section of the Federal Trademark Act that says that names are not inherently protectable, but if you use it in your business for a certain period of time, it can acquire a level of protectability based on how long you've been using it and how widely you've been advertising your services and how long you've been offering your services.
Exactly, like 25 years.
Yeah, you're probably okay. You can
go. Okay, no one's going to take it. And the last thought I have here, I would suggest to anybody listening, I never used to use a computer to email back and forth to people, and now I have a paper trail. Always have a paper trail, because I very often do police work, and they would deny it that I said anything. Now I don't do anything unless I do it on the computer. Because it's a paper trail. It shows exactly what I said to them or what I said to the people in California. Great idea, right?
Yeah,
are you there,
Heather?
Totally
right. And let me circle back to one other thing. I
mm-hmm.
told you earlier in this call that I absolutely recommend that you do your copyright registration online on your own.
Yeah.
I absolutely do not recommend that you do your trademark registration on your own online. You can go online and file your own trademark application. Please don't do it. There are terms of reference they use that can narrow your protection dramatically if you don't know the right answers, and you can end up spending $325 or however many dollars that you spend filing this application, and it can be worthless. It happens all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, me or somebody else, but please don't file your own trademark applications because it ends up being, in most cases, a waste of your money.
Mm-hmm. Heather, I got a quick question regarding the work made for hire doctrine. You also I'm assuming that you're suggesting also to have assignments when you hire a videographer, for example, that it's going to be creating products for you.
anyone who's going to be creating work for you that is creative or original in any way, you're going to want to get an assignment if you want to own the copyright.
Okay.
I think you said bibliographer. Did you say bibliographer?
No, that's coming next. No, I was thinking of, I'm going to give a point, I'm going to have to have one. No, but I was thinking, because I get a lot of products, and I do hire a videographer to do that for me. Like, we had a videographer is what I meant.
Yeah, the videographer is going to own the copyright in that video unless you get an assignment.
So the assignment the assignment has to be given to the videographer before anything is done, right?
It can be done after the fact. If it was always the intention of the parties that you would own the copyright, it is preferable to do it ahead of time.
And what about people that are present, that are part of the program, that they, you know, let's say you're doing a live presentation, which I do a lot of those, and some of them are so juicy that I want to make a product out of it. So do you need to have the participants sign some kind of a release that says, yeah, I understand that you're going to be using this to make money out of this? Or
that's a little bit different. That's a privacy release. And, for example, when you started this call, and any time someone joined, it said this call is being recorded. You actually, as the person who is responsible for the recording, own the copyright in this show.
Okay,
so from a copyright perspective, you're fine. And you've given everybody notice that it's going to be recorded, so you're okay.
Okay, all right. That makes sense.
And you're all on notice now.
The attorney has spoken. Is there any other area that you want to touch base on, Heather, before we wrap this up? This has been so enlightening.
Oh, I can go on forever about this stuff. Is there anything that anybody else feels we need to cover very quickly before we go?
What about e-books?
I'm for them. What do you want to know?
You're going to love it. You're going to fall in love with it.
Am I protected?
Was the question, should you convert your book to an e-book?
No, if I just put, like, copyright at the little symbol,
help? It helps because it prevents the innocent infringement defense. But if you own the, I would suggest, again, that you get your copyright registration through the Copyright Office for your book. And then when you convert it to electronic form, it's still protected. It's still the same work. It's just presented in a different format.
Yeah, you keep on saying that anything that we do, we should actually register with the Copyright Office on an individual basis. Not, I don't know why I was thinking you could bundle up, and I know you said you could, but if anything arises from it and there's a lawsuit, it's going to be more difficult to deal with the whole bundle. Because I was thinking,
well,
like, if I write 3 e-books like she was talking about, I make them all into electronic PDFs that I sell, you're suggesting copyright each one of them, right?
Yes, and in general, if the things are not related, don't put them together. But photographs, for example, very often come in sets, and those would be filed collectively. Or a compact disc of musical works are often filed together. And then if you actually write a periodical, if you write a newsletter or a magazine, I deal with it all the time with some local newspapers, there's actually a way for you to file those as a group. So if you're actually publishing a periodical, there's a procedure for filing those so that you don't have to do each one individually.
Oh, okay. So, and that, too, we put it to the copyright.gov site?
Yes. And there, actually, I don't know if that particular one is available online yet. You're going to want to look for a form GR.
GR,
for registration.
Okay, all right. Yeah, because you know what? I do publish my monthly newsletter, and I do it online. And it never even occurred to do that. I mean, you've given us so much good information in here, and for us to take action and just protect something. You know, one of the things that I was also very passionate about you coming on, you know, on board for this call today is because this is precious. These are precious assets. These are precious. It's part of our legacy. It's what we leave behind, and how do we protect it? And, you know, this is going to go down in history to our children, grandchildren, and
all of the other boyfriends we have left behind. and it is definitely part of our legacy. So I'm really very passionate about how do we want to be remembered. And what better way? You know, one of the most amazing ways for us to be remembered is through our own writings and our own creations. Even if it's just to create a hat. Or a rabbit out of a hat. So this to me has been, priceless, invaluable information. Do we need to talk about patterns at all? Is anybody on the line that would like to talk about patterns?
No, but I just have one more question. Can I ask it? It's Barbara. I'm doing a column for Beauty Forever Network. There's no compensation, but it's a worldwide net kind of thing for women. They have all these women that are shakers and movers, so I'm the only psychic, but I'm going to do dream interpretations. And should I copyright each one of them? It's going on the web.
Yeah. Would you sue someone if they copied it?
Excuse me?
Would I sue
somebody if they copied it? Well, if they said it was their body of work, their thought, their idea.
Here's a way to decide whether you're going to do one copy registration, no copy registrations, or a bunch. If someone was going to take one of your articles and pass it off as their own, and you would be like, well, that's annoying, but whatever, then do a collective registration.
Okay.
If they're going to take one and you would be ready to go down to the courthouse, a month afterwards because you're still mad, then do them one at a time.
Oh, okay. Can I just put the copyright insignia on it? Would that be good enough?
That gets noticed, but again, remember, you can't sue for infringement unless you have the copyright registration, and you can't get attorney's fees in that lawsuit unless you filed it within 3 months after creation.
Okay.
Or before the infringement starts.
Okay.
Well, that 3 months is the key word. And obviously, I guess for graphic designers, I know a few people that that's their body of work. It's they create graphics, and they're actually, a lot of them are visual facilitators for different types of work, whether it's for managerial corporations and things like that, so people can get more visual images as to how the team is supposed to work. And, when you're making all those presentations and all those big boards, and then you turn them into books or into pamphlets or into big binders, how quickly they need to be thinking about how do I protect my work so nobody will be infringing it.
Yeah, it has to be part of your everyday process.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Anybody has any other questions for Heather? Are we all good now?
Yeah.
This has been wonderful. Thank you, everybody, for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And let me give you Heather's contact information one more time. Her telephone number is area code 386. And I just lost your number, Heather. It's 323 what? Say your number again, Heather.
It's 386-323-9220.
And your email address?
My email address is heather.vargas, V as in Victor, A-R-G-A-S, at Cobb, C-O-B-B, Cole, C-O-L-E.com.
Yes, and also if you want to take a look at the at her firm's site, it's www.cobbcole.com, and that will give you a feel for the company that Heather works for. Thank you, everybody. Heather, thank you so much for doing this for us today. And until we meet again, thank you, everybody. And by the way, today is Tuesday, March the 3rd, 2009. Thank you, everybody.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Heather?
Yeah.
Let me go off recording.